Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Jeff Nally, stepping in for Spencer Chase this week. This week's guest is Zach Ducheneau, administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency. Before we discuss ag programs, here's some of the items making news this week. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was in Mexico to start the week and used a meeting with Mexican President Obrador to make the case for approving biotech traits. Vilsack said he didn't have a breakthrough to announce, but said the scheduled one-hour meeting expanded to nearly 2 hours. Over 100 of the nation's pork producers were in Washington this week for the National Pork Producers Council fly-in. Top priorities included preparing for and preventing foreign animal disease, the agriculture labor shortage, and increasing pork exports. While high input costs may be dulling potential farmer enthusiasm for higher commodity prices, the monthly Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer dipped to a reading of 113 for March of 22. That's the lowest since March of 2020. The reading was 12 points lower than March and 36 points lower than March a year ago. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack reported some fresh numbers on the recent Conservation Reserve Program general signup. Looks like there'll be a net loss of approximately 1.4 million general sign-up acres. The secretary says the numbers prove there is no reason for him to open CRP acres for emergency cropping. In the big picture, there are only 22 million acres currently enrolled in CRP, well below the cap of 25.5 million. By the way, that cap expands to 27 million acres in October. Well, while you and I and others may be racing to get our taxes filed to the IRS on time this month, the Farm Service Agency is coming off of a blur of signups for farmers during the month of March. But Zach Ducheneau, the administrator of the Farm Service Agency, says simply, the FSA work is never really done.
With the drought pervading in much of the western part of the country and the delivery of the ad hoc programs that Congress authorizes us to carry out for our producers, we're still whipping and spurring for the finish line that we don't even see yet. So our staff is really doing great work.
So let's think out loud just a little bit. Obviously, all the sign up for ARC and PLC. Yeah. What were the other elements that took place and what still is on the forefront for producers across the country?
ARC and PLC are behind us. Acreage reporting is behind us. We had some close out for some disaster programs on January 31st. So the front quarter of the year has been the calendar year has been pretty busy. Next, we had CRP sign up, and we're really happy with the results we've gotten there so far. In the future, we've got CRP grasslands, but in the middle of all of that, we also have delivered the Emergency Livestock Relief Program authorized by Congress last fall to producers in a very unique way. And this is the first time that I'm aware of that producers haven't had to apply. We had their information from their LFP applications. So livestock producers that were affected by drought are just gonna receive a payment here in the next few days based on that information.
So thinking then about the sign up, how is the staffing, or how is staffing now the Farm Service Agency and your IT structure? Are you set for the challenges that might be ahead of you in future signups, or is there a need?
There's always the need for more hands, but our staff, true to the nature of the producers they serve, get the job done. And I'm really proud to be able to lead this team. We've got staff that have worked overtime, into the night, on the weekends to get all of the things done that are added onto them, because understand that when we get an ad hoc program, we don't have the opportunity to staff up and train for that. So it just falls to other staff that we've got out there, and they knock it out of the park every single time.
We've talked a lot about harmonization over a period of time to make it easier for producers to sign up for various programs and various sides of the agency. Farmers are gathering a tremendous amount of data, and on top of all of this, then the COVID situation kicked in that prevented those face-to-face meetings. In light of this effort and in light of this technology age, are we finding that we're moving to some directions or could be directions to make sign up easier?
That's a really good point, and one that we tried to stress all along. We had normal signups throughout all of COVID when we were not able to do the face-to-face meetings. And we've been itching to get back to those just like everybody else has. The technology that we've adopted to get through those times, we're looking at using in the future to make it easier for the next generation of producers. Because while the average age of the producers is 57, most of them are in my generation and like the paper. Those in my daughter's generation, they just as soon do it on their cell phone if they can. So the technological advances that we've made, the comfort that our staff have developed with the Microsoft Teams environment, having the virtual meetings, is really going to benefit us in the long run.
So also thinking then for those who would like to have that, it's great that they'd have the ability to, but they might not be able to with infrastructure. Another reason why Congress has spent so much money and the Department of Agriculture included to help to improve broadband and cell service across the nation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a big component in other segments of the department is getting that broadband access out there. And we work to accommodate producers all across the country where that isn't an option. We had drop-off boxes. We did decidedly 19th century tech in some cases to build solutions for the producers. We would meet out in the parking lot across the vehicle so we were socially distanced so we could get all of this done. So the staff really couldn't be prouder.
Couldn't give any more accolades to the staff of the Farm Service Agency and the work that they've done. Our guest this week in Newsmakers is Zach Ducheneau, who is the administrator of the Farm Service Agency. Well, CRP has drawn a lot of attention as late, and we're looking at a new farm bill. We'll have more with Zach Ducheneau next.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. I'm Jeff Nally, sitting in for Spencer Chase this week. Our guest is the administrator of the Farm Service Agency, Zach Ducheneau. The conflict in Ukraine, the invasion by Russia, has plenty of questions now, and all eyes are on how many acres will the Ukrainian farmers be able to plant. And even some of the private estimates we have seen as late suggest that despite their efforts, probably corn and wheat acres and other crops are going to be down. A lot of concern about hunger in the world, and some suggest that it's been time to open the CRP to allow additional acres for farmers to respond. The secretary was wise in his comments earlier suggesting it's not time to do that because we didn't know the results of the general sign-up of the last CRP that took place. So what can you share about what's happened and your thoughts on this particular debate right now?
Well, this year we had 3 million acres coming out of CRP with expiring contracts. Producers had the option to exercise there where they could go back into cropping. And a majority of them felt it was appropriate to re-enroll those acres in the CRP program. So the fact that it's a voluntary incentive-based program, I think, really kind of unpacks that argument. Producers always have the option to do something different. And what we're really concerned about is making sure that CRP is a viable option to help take some of those marginal acres or submarginal acres even out of production for the environmental benefit. And another aspect that I don't think is talked about enough is the reserve portion of the Conservation Reserve Program. We're reserving future production when we take that out of crop production. And we used about 3 million acres in emergency haying and grazing last year as a reserve for livestock producers who don't have the same robust safety net as our crop producers have.
This really encompasses, I think, the debate for where the 23 Farm Bill is going to go. Because we have a responsibility to feed the nation and feed the world, but we also have a climate responsibility. That conservation program was established to protect fragile acres. And pulling acres out of that, it might not be feasible but it might be an opportunity. How do you see it?
I don't necessarily agree with the premise that conservation doesn't increase production. Mm-hmm. When we're doing conservation practices that enhance soil health, mm-hmm. we're increasing the productivity of that land. And we need to really focus our climate smart agriculture and our conservation programs on the working lands aspect of conservation. Everyone knows idle land degrades. So we've got to have some animal impact, some action going on there while we keep the cover on to keep the erosion from happening.
If acres were coming out of the conservation reserve, farmers chose not to re-enroll, if those came out, when would that contract end that would allow them to begin some sort of tillage or production?
I think that land would come out next production year. So it might not be something that they could do anyway if we were to take land out of conservation. The acres that are expire at the end of this production season.
So let's talk about ARC and PLC for a moment. We are in a new paradigm, both of the price of inputs that farmers are paying and even the question of the availability of inputs. But at the same time, we're also looking at commodity prices that are higher as well.
Yeah.
And some would suggest that despite the higher commodity price, the net result for some farmers may still be red ink or a very thin margin. If we're talking about the levels of agriculture risk protection or price protection, the safety net that we have today is really far below the cost of production and the commodity price received. In essence, a safety net, if it carried forward, would be a safety net,
yeah,
but awfully close to the ground.
Yeah. My friend Marcia Bunger, the administrator at the Risk Management Agency, during sign-up for crop insurance was really intentional about pointing out that producers can insure at a profit this year. Mm-hmm. And the best way to think about next year is to make sure you've got a plan for this year. We do see that the inputs are up. We've got some well-founded questions about whether that's legitimate supply chain issues or profiteering on the backs of our producers, as happens far too often. We're happy that they've got crop prices that are a little higher to help mitigate that while we help analyze that situation.
So the question would be to Congress, do we raise the levels of protection, anticipating what agriculture prices and returns may be for the future? Or does more of the ultimate risk or total management of risk now fall on the shoulders of farmers and their marketing plans and the work ahead? It's a decision for Congress.
It is a decision for Congress, but I think we need to continue to provide a safety net that's closer to the producers until we pull apart the system that has 11, 12, 13 cents of every food dollar even getting back to the producer. We've got to fix that so there's more equity across that value chain that benefits the producers.
So finally, with regard to the Department of Agriculture, and I think government overall, but especially at USDA, work to make sure that farm programs are equitable for all participants.
Yes.
How strong is that effort, and do you see areas where the USDA can improve its service in the years to come?
Yeah, the first thing we can do to improve our service in years to come is accept the fact that we have treated folks disparately. There's historical fact, there's government study after government study that indicates we have treated socially disadvantaged producers poorer. You have to think about when this institution was created. We were just fresh out of a war where part of the country thought it was worth going to war to own other people in this country. So that's where the Department of Agriculture had its foundation. And then you go forward, Native American people didn't get the right to vote until the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. Women couldn't hold a credit card until the 1970s. So there is an institution that's created in a different reality that may be discriminatory in its foundation. It doesn't mean that people are out there actively being racist or discriminatory. They're just part of the system. And we've got to work to unpack the system and build it so that it focuses more attention on those folks who haven't had a century and a half runway to build equity, build assets, and build resilience.
Well, we've got about a half minute left, and here's an opportunity now that if you had a legal pad and you could make a wish list for Congress for the 23 Farm Bill from the Farm Service Agency, what would you wish for?
I would wish that the Congress made many technical assistance requests of us, because we're in a responsive posture with regard to Farm Bill conversations. We're not advocating, we're responding to the questions that come from the Congress, because they have a better connection to the people out there in the countryside.
I want to thank you very much for being with us on this edition of AgriPulse Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me, it's been great.
Well, when AgriPulse Newsmakers continues, we'll come back with a panel of experts and talk about farm programs and look ahead at the challenges of meeting the supply needs of the nation. In the meantime, Hannah Pagel is with us, and this segment of Map It Out gives us a look at the infection rate of highly pathogenic avian influenza in the nation.
Poultry and egg producers are closely watching the spread of highly pathogenic avian influenza, which has already hit operations in more states than the 2014-2015 outbreak. The loss of egg-laying hens couldn't come at a worse time for consumers, who usually ratchet up egg purchases prior to Easter, but may find them to be even costlier this year. The current outbreak was first detected in a commercial flock in Indiana in February, and wild birds quickly carried the disease to several other states. Since then, more than 22 million birds have been affected, with over 18 million of those birds belonging to egg layer and pullet operations, according to USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. If you take a look at this map, you can see a snapshot of where HIPATH has been detected in the U.S. So far this year, there have been over 90 detections in commercial flocks in 14 states, according to the latest USDA data. Some of the largest confirmed cases are in Iowa, where detections at commercial layer facilities caused 5.3 million chickens in Buena Vista County and another 5 million birds from an Osceola County flock to be destroyed. As the numbers continue to rise, it's too early to estimate the economic impact the outbreak will eventually have on poultry and egg producers, as well as consumers. However, the Congressional Research Service estimated the last outbreak valued turkey and laying hen losses at nearly $1.6 billion, with a $3.3 billion economy-wide loss. You can read more details on the HIPATH outbreak and Steve Davies' story on AgriPulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to this week's AgriPulse Newsmakers. Now we turn to a distinguished panel of guests, and we'll be talking about some of the same issues that Administrator Ducheneau offered in just a moment. First, let me make introductions. With us today is Mary Kay Thatcher from Syngenta. We have Brad Doyle with us as well, the president of the American Soybean Association. And also we welcome Bobby Frederick with the National Grain and Feed Association. Bobby, I want to start with you and start this way. The Grain and Feed Association was one of a group of other agriculture organizations that asked the Secretary of Agriculture to open up some acres from the Conservation Reserve. Those requests appear to have been null. What's your next step, and what concerns do you have about available supply for this year and the year to come?
Well, good morning, Jeff. Thanks. It's great to be with you. You know, this is something that our International Trade and Ag Policy Committee talked about at our convention last month. You know, the breadbasket of Europe has been attacked. It's hard to know when or how long the invasion will last, but we do know that many analysts are saying it's going to be a long-term event. I know one of NGFA's members, Ken Zuckerberg with CoBank, just has an analysis out that we're going to see supply shocks to the grain system and disruptions for at least the next two growing seasons. So we took a look at the Conservation Reserve Program, and the according to the most recent data, the 4.1 million acres that are prime farmland. This is the land that has the best physical and chemical characteristics to be grown for food, fiber, feed, etc. And we just think at this juncture, it should be accessible through emergency cropping. Again, not all of CRP, not all of general CRP, but specifically that one out of every 4 acres within general CRP that is that prime farmland. We just don't think this is the time to keep that locked up. So as far as next steps, you know, again, this is going to have reverberations for the next few years. So we're taking a we'll see approach. We're going to keep on pushing for this. We saw that the secretary talked about some of the numbers this week with respect to general signups being lower and more you know, higher grasslands expected. So I think those numbers are positive. But for the life of CRP in the 30 plus year history, for the majority of that time, general signup has been the majority. And it was only this past year that it dipped under 50%. So again, we're looking at the prime farmland. And again, we'll keep on looking at this issue.
Brad Doyle will look at the Department of Agriculture's prospective plantings report, and the USDA said a lot more soybean acres, 91 million, and corn not as much at 89.5. Some might suggest that farmers would like that opportunity to maybe pull some of those acres out of CRP and plant. And other farmers would suggest we're already having a hard enough time trying to find inputs for the year. And if you open up more acres, you're going to lower the price, so you'd take a hit on both ends. Where does the Soybean Association stand on this particular subject?
I think the great thing about soybeans are they are very versatile in rotation. So you can make that transition from corn, in my area, be rice, cotton. So 91 million projection, I believe that does put it above corn for this year and maybe the second highest in many years. And a lot of that has to do with the you know, the nitrogen fixation process that soybeans allow without the need for additional nitrogen inputs. Phosphorus inputs are low on soybean too, so it's kind of a budget decision. And labor involved in soybean production is lower as well. Prices are good. That is what drives the planting practices for farmers, the choices they make. So we're really excited. We're going into spring right now, planting, just getting started here. Everyone's excited to get this crop in the ground. We've had our frustrations with inputs, you know, supply, demand, price, and all of that. So we're going to get there. We're looking for a great year with soybeans.
Mary Kay Thatcher with Syngenta, what challenges have you experienced with the supply chain, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine? The overall COVID situation that carries on, how do you stand as a company perspective for U.S. farmers here as we hopefully get an opportunity to get this planting season underway?
Well, Jeff, I think you make a really good point about there being two different viewpoints on opening up the CRP. And I think that really what we have to remember is this war isn't going to be over next week. We're probably in it for a while. And so this is going to be a medium and long-term issue to try to balance feeding a hungry world, the food security that's been caused by Ukraine, and working on the climate change, weather change, greenhouse gas emissions. I have to believe that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Will it be easy? No, but I think we do. We do have employees in both Ukraine and Russia and have been in pretty much constant contact with them. A lot of our employees in Ukraine, their families have left, but they're on the job. They want to stay. They want to help farmers get something planted in Ukraine this year. If they can. So certainly we're going to have to look at whether it's CRP or other things. You know, one other quick thing I'd throw out is I think this is a good time to make lemonade out of lemons and look at things like the Europeans not necessarily approving biotech products, the Chinese, dealing with Mexican President Obrador and his opposition to glyphosate and to GMO corn. This is a really good opportunity to seize the moment and go in and say, look, you know, we're going to have major food security problems around the world. You need to come around.
So there is a thought that, number one, you come up with more acres to allow for greater production, or you allow more technology to be approved to grow more on each acre. And Brad, I would have to believe that there's technology by Syngenta, by other companies that are waiting the wings, that are waiting for approval, or Mary Kay, as you suggested, countries to approve those technologies to allow farmers the greatest use of efficiency, protecting the environment, yes, but also increasing productivity. How big of a holdback is that for you, Mary Kay?
Oh, it's definitely a holdback because, you know, when you look at something like no new biotech products being approved in Mexico for 8 years, and you look at it being our number one corn market, our number two market overall, it sends a signal back to the companies. How much effort do I want to put to products that are in the pipeline if I'm not going to be able to sell them to my number one, number two, number three customer?
Brad, how important is that technology that has enabled you to protect soil, but at the same time also increase your yield?
You know, in the United States, we're losing acres every year due to urban sprawl, if you want to call it, industry. As our economy grows, we need more factories, more land to build those factories. And we're taking that at the expense, a lot of times, of very highly productive farmland. So as a farmer myself, I need to make more per acre, not only more yield, but also more profit. And those high technology products, genetics, traits, they allow us to do that. We're more efficient at what we do. We have very limited time each year to get a crop in and make everything go in our favor to fill our grain bins. And that's what helps feed the world. So those products are very important to me. In the South here, in Arkansas, Palmer pigweed, it is a huge battle for us. We've got some traits out there that are outstanding on controlling that and reducing the stress they put on our plants and maintain our high yield. So that, to me, is very important to us to fulfill the customer's needs worldwide.
Well, our guests on this panel, Brad Doyle with the American Soybean Association, Bobby Frederick with the National Grain and Feed Association, and Mary Kay Thatcher of Syngenta. We'll have more with this panel after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Bobby Frederick is with us of the National Grain and Feed Association, a part of our distinguished panel today. Bobby, the thought is the Farm Service Agency and the programs that are in the 18 Farm Bill as we move ahead to the 23. Are the programs that were in the 18 adequate as a safety net, do you feel, to provide the supply of grain that you'll need in the years to come in this new economic climate that farmers are facing today?
Jeff, thank you for the question. You know, I would be deferential to our grower and commodity friends here. I think generally speaking, yes. I know NGFA, we want to support our producer friends as these Title I programs come up, and we are generally supportive, obviously, crop insurance, hugely supportive of that, and Title I programs that don't influence planting decisions. But essentially, just putting a bow on the CRP conversation real quickly, we want the same thing as USDA. I mean, Undersecretary Bonnie at his confirmation hearing talked about getting the right lands in the program and not taking highly productive land into CRP, and that's what it's all about. So I think if you can get that part of Title II right and you can get that part of Title I right, that's a strong way forward. This administration has been very focused on these supply chain issues as well, with the Surface Transportation Board and Secretary Vilsack's letter, which we greatly appreciated, to try to get acceptable rail service restored to ag stakeholders. So Title I Farm Bill, Title II Farm Bill, getting that mix right, working on supply chain issues, that will help with the grain supply and helping our members deliver their role in the ag supply chain.
Mary Kay Thatcher, you've got extensive experience with farm programs here on the Hill, and it's very difficult to look ahead for what a new farm bill should offer when you're in the climate that you're in today. Inputs are higher, challenges are higher, commodity prices are higher, but the margin is still thin. The stakes are stronger. What's the caution for these committees as they start to evaluate and also craft a policy for the next 5 years?
Well, one of the things that concerns me most, Jeff, is all the people that are talking about, oh, maybe we should go to more of a permanent disaster program. I think we have to be really careful with that. We've worked long and hard for 30 or 40 years now to build a crop insurance program that really works. I think we've got something like 91% of the acreage in this country, the major crop acreage that's covered by crop insurance. So, you know, we certainly don't want to come in with a disaster program that would take away from that. I think especially as we get more and more urban people who don't understand things, for us to be able to go to the Hill and support crop insurance by talking about how farmers have skin in the game, how they do pay a portion of the premiums, is a lot easier to sell than it is to just go on ad hoc disaster assistance programs. So I think we have to be really, really careful about that. The other thing I would say is that this will be my 9th farm bill. I know there was one, maybe two of the other 8 farm bills where we did get a little bit of extra money to be able to spend to write a new farm bill. But mostly we go into it at a zero-sum game. So if we want to do things like increase loan rates or ARC payments or PLC or whatever, the money's probably going to have to come from elsewhere in the commodity title. It's certainly not going to come out of the nutrition title. Now, if portion of the Build Back Better and the $27 billion in new conservation funding indeed comes through, that'll be a big help. Then we will have indeed some money that we can try to do to even strengthen the safety net. But if there's no new money, it's going to be pretty darn hard.
Brad Doyle, I would have to believe that soybean farmers like yourself don't want to be caught in a debate of an either or, either risk protection and crop insurance or climate. You'd like to be able to maintain the safety net, but also have the opportunity to advance your conservation practices and carbon sequestration.
So yeah, farmers, you know, we love opportunities, especially when they're voluntary and incentive-based. And I think there's a real fit for the climate smart money that will be available if we play our cards right. We don't want to force anything upon farmers because we resist really easily when we are required to do something. If you offer a fair program for more no-till acres, more cover crop, more grass water waste practices, a lot of practices we are already doing, we will increase that very easily. So it's got to be voluntary. In my area here, we've been slow to adopt because we're very flat and we have very little erosion from hillsides, because we just simply don't have them. We're very flat, and that causes a lot of waterlogging in the wintertime, so cover crops don't necessarily grow well here, but we're working on it. Research helps improve that. Checkoff funding is funding some research projects, and we hope that we will have a participation here within our state. I'm very confident of that, but it will need to be that voluntary program that I'm speaking about that will make it happen.
Well, I'd like to thank each of you for being with us on this week's panel, talking about policy that we have today and looking into the future. Brad Doyle with ASA, Mary Kay Thatcher with Syngenta, and Bobby Frederick with the National Grain and Feed Association. We'll be back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but in this week's Ag by the Numbers, Hannah Pagel has a look at the U.S. Ag Export Outlook.
According to the February outlook for U.S. agricultural trade, ag exports are projected to hit a new record at $183.5 billion in fiscal year 2022, up $8 billion from the November 2021 forecast. Increases are expected in most commodity groups, with oilseeds leading the surge. Soybean exports are forecasted to be over $31 billion due to higher prices and lower global supplies. Overall, grain and feed exports are projected to increase to almost $43 billion due to more demand for wheat as well as higher feed and fodder forecasts. Mexico is forecasted to overtake Canada as the second largest U.S. agricultural market, with a projection of $27 billion, up $3.5 billion from November. Exports to Canada are forecasted at $26 billion, a $2 billion increase. The forecast for exports to China is unchanged at $36 billion. China is expected to remain the largest U.S. agricultural market in fiscal year 2022. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Well, here's what's on the horizon. Progress will come to a halt on Capitol Hill during the two-week Easter break. We'll keep an eye on potential House action on the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. Will the House members approve the Senate language or look for changes and then a compromise with senators? And commodity traders will keep an eye on spring weather for planting progress in the U.S. and any sign of La Nina's impact on the Safrinha corn crop in Brazil. Damage to that crop could further challenge global feed grain supplies. Well, thanks for watching this week's AgriPulse Newsmakers. Thanks to Hannah Pagel and the rest of the AgriPulse News team. For Spencer Chase, I'm Jeff Nally.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.